Easter is a difficult holiday for Unitarian Universalists. The Christian interpretation, as we often understand it, seems impossible to really believe. It's soaked in both superstition and irrationality. Sometimes spring celebrations are a good thing, there's no question about that. But spring itself doesn't quite address the aspect of reality that Easter is trying to lead us to. And I say this as a person who's very strongly pro-Easter Bunny. There's a difficulty widely in humanity in dealing with the reality and the mystery of when life begins and ends. Science and medicine itself have difficulty knowing exactly when a person should be declared dead. Life, likewise, when exactly is the moment life begins? The moment that life begins is not something that really science and medicine deals with. It's a legal question. And it's a legal question that has moved around a lot during just the last few decades. And the reason why, both legalistically and scientifically, we have trouble determining exactly when life begins or ends is that life is not digital. It's not a series of offs and ons, yeses and nos, zeros and ones. Life is not, I maintain, digital, but analog. Life and death merge into each other with no clear space in between. The great question, what happens to us after death? But there is another question that is kind of implied by that, that is almost never asked, and that is, where were we before we were born? You know, the normal definition of Christianity is eternal life. Yet, we normally define that as beginning at your birthday and then going on for all eternity if you accept the Christian doctrine. That's an interesting and, I would say, ultimately narcissistic way of thinking of eternity, as having begun when you were born and then going on. Well, what about all that time, if it was eternity? Your life and you are not bound in any direction. A Zen Buddhist koan is, what is your face before you were born? That's something to contemplate. And it's something to contemplate precisely because it's difficult or impossible to conceptualize. So we think we were created at birth on August 12, 1961, and go on forever? Well, what about all that time before? There's various metaphors of life after death. The metaphor that Judaism uses is a tribal one. We are part of a tribe. Our entire being is wrapped up with my people, with my tribe. There's no real individual that goes on after death. The Old Testament word to speak of life after death is almost inevitably Sheol, which means the grave. Likewise, with native peoples everywhere, they think of their life as being so intrinsically tied up with their tribe that they don't really conceive of an individual destiny. There's no individual continuation. Kurt Vonnegut, of all people, expressed this quite well, I think. He was sort of a Unitarian Universalist, as many of us are. And he was a humanist. And he called himself an atheist regarding Jehovah only. This is from Cat's Cradle. God made mud. God got lonesome. So God said to some of the mud, "Sit up, see all I've made," said God. "The hills, the sea, the sky, and the stars." And I was some of the mud that got to sit up and look around. Lucky me, lucky mud. I, mud, sat up and saw what a nice job God had done. Nice going, God. Nobody but you could have done it. God, I certainly couldn't have. I feel very unimportant compared to you. The only way I can feel the least bit important is to think of all the mud that didn't even get to sit up and look around. I got so much, and most mud got so little. Thank you for the honor. Now mud lies down and goes to sleep. What memories for mud to have. What interesting and other kinds of sitting up mud I met. I loved everything I saw. Thank you. Good night. Now, I think this is a metaphor that is also rather scientifically satisfying. Our approach to death and immortality naturally suffers from a narrow personal perspective. For instance, there were once two leaves next to each other on a tree. And one of the leaves said to the other, "I just heard something horrible." "What?" "I heard about this thing called photosynthesis. Do you know anything about that?" And the other leaf says, "Well, the way I understand it, there's something inside of us that uses light energy to turn carbon dioxide into sugar. And that is what nurtures us. But when the light lessens, we turn colors, and then we finally shrivel up and fall to the ground." And the other leaf says, "That won't happen to me. I jog." The leaf thinks he can forever delay the natural processes. So think of that leaf. One of so many leaves on the tree, and like snowflakes, each leaf is supposed to be entirely unique. No other leaf like it. And I remember, even as a kid, thinking, "Who's checking?" Because if they're very different, well, but they're also really very similar. And it seems as though you might want to stress the similarity as well as the difference. But that was me as a kid, and that's why I am where I am today. Each leaf has its own value for its life. And I think that a leaf could conceivably understand that there was a leaf very much like itself next to it. But I wonder, what does that leaf know of the branch, that part of life that connects the leaf to something larger? And that branch, what might it know of the tree? And the tree, what does it know of the forest? What does the forest know of the land? What does the land know of the earth and the earth of the solar system? And does the solar system know the universe? And does the universe know itself? And if it does it ever say, "Is there anyone else out there like me?" Does it ever get an answer? And the closest I ever get to that question is when I'm in an airplane. Because when I'm in an airplane, I see most clearly how small I am, quite literally. And there's also that moment every time I go up in an airplane where I say, "I hope I don't crash." So there's a sense of the vastness of what is not me and the importance I place on my own life. So I see how clearly large the largeness is beyond me. But also, as I'm sitting there, I also know how my small life and the person sitting next to me are of immense importance. And in this, I find neither faith nor belief terribly helpful. Religious doctrine is often a defense against spirituality, a defense against thinking too hard about things. We all go to heaven, or those ones who are anointed go to heaven, or the rest of us go to hell, or we do or do not have an eternal soul, or we must be born again or not. All of these things seem to me a defense against understanding what might lie beyond. Likewise, well, when you die, you're dead, and that's it. Well, that's another kind of doctrine. Really, is that all? What about me personally? Now, I think that Daryl Berger is not all that important, though I certainly believe he is now. I've been given a little bit of mud to move around, and I ought to do it as skillfully as possible. But after death, Daryl Berger will be remembered only for a very short time. And I'm reminded of that romantic poem that I should have looked up for this sermon, called Ozymandias, where the statue is submerged and its eye will be forever conquering. And I think of even the Alexander's greats and the Genghis Khans and the people that we have known for decades and centuries will be known for such a short length of time compared to truly eternity. But the consciousness that shines through Daryl Berger to you, and I get back again, that awareness, that's not really mine, you know. It's not really ours. We just participate in it. You have some of it, and so do I, and so do I believe the trees and the birds and even the rocks, for yes, I am an animist. I believe, after some examination, that this keeps on, that this goes on within you and without you. Meanwhile, in the midst of all this metaphysical speculation, which always seems to resolve or degenerate into poetry, into contemplating one's immortality in the face of one's clear aging or increased infirmity, how to keep the leaf that is you from photosynthesizing any sooner than necessary, every once in a while you have an experience that brings you up short, that reminds you of what you're supposed to be doing here. At the Passover that we celebrate, one day we are reminded we too were immigrants. One day we are reminded we too were once in bondage. And we are all immigrants in this world, really. There's a great gospel hymn, "I am a pilgrim and a stranger, traveling through this worrisome land. I've got a home in that yonder city," and he says, "it's not made by hand. It's not created. We came from somewhere, and we're going somewhere." And the question is not exactly where did we come from and where do we go, as interesting to contemplate as it might be, but really what to do in the meantime. There is a vastness beyond our comprehension, yet the person next to me is of immense importance. And both of these together are the Easter, the vastness of without and the vast importance of the person next to me. And that's why those very last words in the Gospel of John, his last appearance to his disciples, are so important. What did they see? Was it a vision and hallucination? There's a new book out called How Jesus Became God by a professor at Chapel Hill called Bart Ehman. And he reminds us that, you know, often people hear or see visions of loved ones immediately after they die. I remember in 1963, my grandfather died, and my grandmother saying to me, "I feel at night like he's still with me." They were together for 55 years. Of course, she felt like he was still with her. And so I think when the disciples are seeing that vision of the person that they love so much, that's what they were saying to each other. He's still with us. We still feel his spirit. Something about him is not gone. Now, what was that final message? He had this last thing to say to his beloved disciples before he went to that place not made by hand. And was it keep the laws? No. Did he say remember me? No. Did he say make a religion out of my life and develop a priesthood only of men? No. Did he say you must be born again? He did not. It was feed my lambs. This is what his final message was. The final thing that his followers should remember and learn from his example. There's no yesterday or tomorrow. These are mere ideas. Time is an invention to keep us from having to do everything at once. He told us, tend my sheep, for that's all there has ever been for us now in this place. To remember that there is a vastness beyond our comprehension, yet the person next to me is of immense importance. What ought we to do? Feed my sheep. May we join together in our closing hymn. Number 61.